I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Radio Times, I'm Alan Tu, sitting in for Marty Moscowane. Today on Radio Times, how do we know if the war on terror is working? And if it's not, have we gone so far into it that it's too late to change course? My guest Ian Lustick argues that in the post-9/11 hysteria, there's been no room on a national level to have a fair discussion on whether the war on terror is actually effective. He says criticism is too quickly labeled as unpatriotic, and now 5 years into the war on terror, with its seemingly limitless budget, it's taken a life of its own as universities and private companies retool themselves to be seen as critical tools on this war on terror, and they're cashing in on our fears and on government contracts. In the 5 years since 9/11, we've spent, by his estimate, more than $500 billion on the two wars and homeland security. This morning, we're joined by Ian Lustick. He is a professor of political science and the Bess W. Hayman Chair at the University of Pennsylvania. And his latest book is Trapped in the War on Terror, which asked at its core, is the war on terror working? Ian Lustick, welcome to Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Ian, your book covers many areas, but I first wanted to start with just getting your definition of sort of the war on terror. Is it just the two wars and homeland security?
The war on terror is a gigantic enterprise that is manipulated by every interest group in the country to make it what they need it to be for them to succeed. So for the gun control lobby, for example, the war on terror is a struggle against the possibility that weapons could get in the hands of terrorists, and therefore what the gun control lobby has always said, therefore we have to limit guns in the streets, they should get more funding, more support for their projects. The National Rifle Association says the war on terror is obviously Americans trying to protect themselves against evil terrorists. Therefore, just as they've always said, more money and more public support has to come to put more guns into the hands of Americans so that we can protect ourselves from those terrorists. So the war on terror is not actually a strategic, well-disciplined, carefully calibrated attempt to protect ourselves against a particular threat. What it has become is a system of its own that controls us and our politicians more than we are controlling it.
When we talk about spending an estimated $500 billion, $500 billion, is that money what you believe the government has spent?
If we look at just what the federal government has spent, we can see, according to the General Accounting Office recent report in July, that $430 billion has been spent just on the war on terror overseas. That would include, of course, the Afghan and Iraqi wars and money for reservists and National Guard-related activities here at home. But beyond that, we're talking about another at least $200 billion spent by the federal government and Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice and other agencies spread on all kinds of projects. So altogether, we're up there over $600 billion already.
You mentioned about how this war on terror is rippling into American society, and you say like universities are not exempt from this; that they're finding ways to cash in.
Universities and politicians, Beltway Bandit consulting firms, the largest corporations in America. No one can be immune to this. Universities find that they can make money and attract students, attract research funds by developing special centers to study terrorism or to study counterterrorism. It's as if there are billions and billions of dollars blowing in the wind, and corporations and universities put catcher's mitts up in the air to catch the money. And every time a company or a university or a political party advocates support in order to fight the war on terror and then gets that support, that reinforces the importance in those people's minds and others that, oh, fighting the war on terror is right. It's the thing to do. It's the way you get support, and it crushes even more heavily any opportunity for serious criticism of it.
Right. And so you're saying, and I think you just, is that increasingly more and more entities and people are benefiting from the very fear of terrorism.
Yes. You know, Franklin Roosevelt famously said when we were fighting a real world war, a World War II, that fear was the only thing we had to fear. But that is much, much more true now, even though the enemy we face is of no significance whatsoever compared to those we faced in World War II. The reason is that in World War II, we were fighting an enemy that had tremendous military and political strength, and we were measuring our entire society's capacity to resist against theirs. It's kind of a gigantic arm wrestling match. And what Roosevelt was telling us is we've got more strength than they do. So don't be afraid, just mobilize that strength. But now we're fighting not an arm wrestling match, though we'd like to be with Al-Qaeda and its clones. We're in a judo contest in which the enemy, Al-Qaeda and its clones, use our strength against us and use our fears against us. So, for example, they hijacked planes from the best transportation system in the world to knock down our buildings and attack the Pentagon. But then they hijacked something much more damaging. The war on terror used by a small cabal in the administration in order to camouflage their desire to invade Iraq took on a life of its own and played into the hands of Al-Qaeda by hijacking the free enterprise system of the United States and Madisonian competitive democracy, urging all Americans to find ways that they could advocate their interests in the language of the war on terror, spinning it out of control and helping bin Laden take satisfaction in what he has called a partnership between Al-Qaeda and the American government.
Now, in your book, Trapped in the War on Terror, you talk about that the jihadists that launched the attacks on 9/11 were, in many ways, desperate for credibility, desperate for attention, and were actually quite marginalized. And it was through this act, as you say, taking on the most powerful government in the world, that has elevated them, and then our reaction to 9/11 has only sustained that.
That's right. One of the best books written on this topic is by Fawaz Girgis, The Far Enemy, in which he shows just how distraught the Ayman al-Zawahiri and others like him were, how isolated and what failures they were. The brilliance that they had was to say, let us goad the great Satan, you know, the United States, into some kind of massive attack on the Middle East, sending their armies into the Middle East in order to make our rhetoric, our discourse, our talk about jihad against the Christians and the Jews, our talk about what history is really about, meaningful to Muslims, because at that time it wasn't. It wasn't striking a chord. Their position in Muslim society was mostly like that of the Aryan nations in America, completely on the margins, wacky. But when the United States responded to their self-declared jihad with what it was in a sense exactly what they predicted, a Christian crusade, as they can portray it, then the world and defines this little group of criminals as an enemy akin to the Axis powers, that made them look just the way they wanted to look in the eyes of hundreds of millions of Muslims. So we are fighting a war now in Iraq and around the world that is playing exactly by a script written by Osama bin Laden.
Are you giving some of these terrorist groups a little bit too much credit, though? I mean, do you think that prior to the 9/11 attacks that they actually had envisioned the United States launching these types of wars against the Muslim countries? I mean, do you think they really anticipated that?
Yes, I do. And that's why I mentioned the book that I did, but there are others. And in my book, I quote from an astonishing speech of Osama bin Laden himself. Now, we all know that Osama bin Laden issued a videotape right before the last presidential election. But we are not in this country allowed, really, or encouraged to know our enemy very well, to actually study the enemy. If we studied the enemy the way we studied the Soviet enemy, we would find a rational response. But we are not encouraged to actually listen to what he says, only that he released this tape brazenly. But let me read you, if I may,
Go ahead.
Something from the end of a long videotape that the American people never heard. It has been easy, said bin Laden, for us to provoke and bait this administration. All that we have had to do is to send two jihadists to the furthest point east to raise a piece of cloth on which is written Al-Qaeda in order to make the generals race there to cause America to suffer human, economic, and political losses without their achieving for it anything of note other than some benefits for their private companies. So we are continuing this policy in bleeding America to the point of bankruptcy. That being said, when one scrutinizes the result, one cannot say that Al-Qaeda is the sole factor in achieving these spectacular gains. Rather, the policy of the White House that demands the opening of war fronts to keep their various corporations busy, whether they be working in the field of arms or oil or reconstruction, has helped Al-Qaeda to achieve these enormous results. And so it has appeared to some analysts and diplomats that the White House and us are playing as one team toward the economic goals of the United States, even if the intentions differ. For example, Al-Qaeda spent $500,000 on the 9/11 attacks, while America, in the incident and in its aftermath, lost, according to the lowest estimate, more than $500 billion, meaning that every dollar of Al-Qaeda defeated $1 million by the permission of Allah, besides the loss of a huge number of jobs. Now, they were thinking along those lines as good judo players before the war. Use the enemy's strength against them.
But I was thinking with the economic statement, which came out, 2004 by Osama bin Laden,
yes,
about bleeding the United States, was that maybe that was sort of a tacked-on goal because of their failure to actually attack the United States since 9/11, sort of a consolation prize.
Well, the image that we have, for example, from the 9/11 Commission, which has many people respect greatly, and I think it's done very good work on practical issues such as airplane protection. But when it comes to understanding what the enemy is, they've done a disservice to America. They've said, we don't need to think about what the enemy wants. We know what they want. They just want to kill and hurt Americans. That is a simplistic and self-destructive way of looking at the enemy. And that's the way our government has been and our people have been defining the enemy. Al-Qaeda is much smarter than that. Their interest is not simply to hurt Americans. Their interest is to create a certain kind of spectacular event in the United States that would trigger an even more spectacular American response, thereby giving them political openings in the Muslim world that they never would have had before. And that's what they're primarily interested in. We find in every red teaming exercise in our country.
What is red teaming, real quick?
Red teaming is giving smart people the opportunity to think, how would they attack the United States if they wanted to hurt us? And every one of those shows how easy it is to hurt Americans and kill Americans. Every day we turn on our TV screens and we hear of a shooting there, a bomb there. Why hasn't Al-Qaeda exploited this? It's mainly because that's not what they're interested in, putting poison in our milk supply or something like that. But until we think that way, we are trapped into believing that any bad thing that could happen, Al-Qaeda might be planning. Any bad thing that could happen, we must charge our government to protect against, which it cannot. So every politician then can criticize every other politician for not protecting against some possible disaster that Al-Qaeda's got us thinking about.
Okay, we're coming up on a break, but are you kind of suggesting that they really are not making that much efforts to plan an attack on the United States?
We have to assume that they are trying to do what will help them best, and that will include probably big attacks once in a while. Therefore, we have to invest a disciplined, careful, well-funded effort in a discreet way, law enforcement, intelligence, to defeat those threats, but not to lose control of the process.
Our guest is Ian Lustig. He's author of Trapped in the War on Terror. This is Radio Times. I'm Alan Tu, in today for Marty Moskowitz. More Radio Times after this break.
United Way of Delaware supports WHYY. Their Community Impact Fund provides year-round support to health and human service programs that serve children, families, seniors, and others in need of assistance. United Way administrators can help you create a personalized giving portfolio to support the issues you care about most. United Way of Delaware, impacting our community by focusing on what matters. Details online at www.uwde.org.
Abortion is a highly charged topic. Debates about abortion are always passionate, but rarely compassionate, taking into account the emotional needs of those dealing with unwanted pregnancy. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll discuss grief after abortion and find out what one man is doing to provide help and guidance without moral judgment. That's today at noon, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The University of Delaware's Alfred Lerner College of Business and Economics supports WHYY and offers drop-in days, Wednesday, September 20th and 27th, from 4:30 to 6:30 at Lerner Hall, Newark Campus. Admission staff will be there to explain how working professionals can complete a part-time AACSB-accredited MBA at nearby locations, 302-UD1-2221 or mba.udel.edu. University of Delaware MBA. It's where you're going that counts.
This is Radio Times. I'm Alan Tu, in for Marty Moskowain, and we are discussing whether we're trapped in this war on terror and whether it's working or not. Our guest is Ian Lustig. He's author of Trapped in the War on Terror. Lustig is a professor and the Bess M. Hayman Chair of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. And we want to know what you think. I mean, is President Bush right that the threat of Islamic militants is equal to the threat of, say, the Soviet Union during the Cold War? Does the risk of a terror attack justify what we're spending? And what do you think? How long can we continue with this pace? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Also want to mention that Ian Lustig will be doing a book reading this Thursday. That's going to be September 21st. This one's going to be at the Penn Bookstore at 5:30. Also, he has one scheduled for Wednesday, October 4th at the Free Library in Center City. I want to just kind of get your assessment, Ian Lustig, in terms of the risk of an attack on U.S. soil. I mean, I gather from the book that you think the actual risk of a terror attack is much smaller than what we're led to believe. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes.
Okay. And then who do you blame for stoking this fear? I mean, is it just President Bush? Or are there others?
The original blame, as it were, was in the group that saw in 9/11 and the tremendous trust that the American people then put in President Bush, its opportunity to get something that it had wanted but couldn't get, namely an invasion of Iraq and the transformation of American foreign policy in what it called a heroic direction that they thought would help conservative Republicans win elections over social Democrat-type Democrats. But in order to get American public support for that, they had to make a connection between Iraq and 9/11. And the way they did it was to say what we're involved in here is a global war on terror, like World War II. So everything is connected. The war in Iraq politically has gone south. It's nobody's advantage anymore. But the war on terror that was created to protect it has taken on a life of its own and is no longer being controlled by that cabal that started it. One of the few true believers in the idea is President Bush. You have to go up pretty high in the administration to find people who believe anymore in the rhetoric. It's only the top level that seems to actually believe it. Everyone else is caught up in a whirlwind of self-justification and aggrandizement that is encouraged by the character of American politics, which tells everyone, go out and get as much as you can using whatever arguments work and let everybody else fight for what they want. When everyone's operating on a false belief that there's a terrorist threat that might generate any kind of bad attack in the United States, then it's practically unstoppable. It's practically impossible to distinguish in the public mind between serious things that money ought to be spent on, for example, making sure that nuclear materials don't get in the hands of potential terrorists, and trivial things like the kind of brouhaha we heard over this Abu Dhabi controlling the ports, which was pure politics and had nothing to do with security.
Now, the government annually gives out Homeland Security dollars to cities based on, I guess, some kind of formula of perceived risk of a terrorist attack. And, you know, on paper, that seems like a pretty fair and logical way to hand out money. Is this what you're talking about? I mean, is this what you'd like to see more of?
Well, the government has tried, especially Secretary Department of Homeland Security Chertoff, to introduce some rationality into this process, but it's essentially impossible to be rational. I'll give you two examples. Early on, there were 160 sites identified by the government as critical to be protected against terrorism. But Congressman said, wait a minute, there aren't too many of those sites in my district. I think my district's got lots of sites to protect. And the next year, they came up with a total of 1,849 sites. But, you know, it kept going because the next year they felt, well, wait a minute, I've got more important sites, many important sites in mind. It went up to 28,000, then 77,000. And now if you add up everything, including the National Asset Database, there are over 300,000 sites. So that's one sense in which the process of trying to divvy up the money rationally doesn't work. Another thing that happens is, should it go to the urban areas where people say, well, they hit like 9/11, they've got this these big iconic targets, or the rural areas? After all, that's where Timothy McVeigh hit. And what when they came up with a formula that was based on some kind of assessment of risk, there was a revolt in Congress. There was a revolt in either direction. So the decision was finally, let's do it half and half. Half will just split it up on a state-by-state basis, so Wyoming gets more per capita than anybody else just about. And on the other half of the money, we'll give away in this way. We also have this very interesting system of 15 national planning scenarios that were drawn up so that every locality and state has to use one of these 15 and only these 15 disasters if they're going to get any money. And who chose these 15 disasters? Why do you have a hoof and mouth disease but not the possibility of a liquid national gas tanker being attacked? Because certain groups inside government departments were successful in getting their experts' opinions and their budgets advanced, and others were not. Because if one scenario were excluded, they wouldn't be able to justify more spending for them. But what's very strange is when you look at these 15 scenarios, where did they come from? Who do they think is going to carry out this chemical attack on a stadium? It never says Al-Qaeda. The enemy is called the universal adversary. Well, that's extraordinarily illuminating because it means that we have no ability, by understanding who our adversary is, to think what might or might not happen with more likelihood. Instead, you're basically trying to fight Satan, the universal adversary, capable of anything, only interested in evil, and with unlimited resources. And that paralyzes us and paralyzes and humiliates our government.
Now, I want to ask you, since, President Bush and others kind of make the enemy this kind of all-knowing everywhere, who do you think the enemy really is? And is it really the threat that we believe it to be? Who are we actually fighting?
We have enemies in this world, and the most important ones are not extremist Muslim terrorists, though they are our enemies as well. China, well, not an official enemy, is an enormous potential threat over the next 10 to 20 years, and that's mostly where our attention ought to go. The instability of state-to-state conflict in the Middle East, including those instabilities being stoked by our overreaction to the terrorist threat, is a much bigger threat to us than the terrorists themselves. If we could focus just on this discrete text, we would see that that it is, in fact, a law enforcement problem. These are criminals. The British do not, even though the threat on British and European soil is much greater than on American soil because of the kind of Muslim minorities they have there, they do not participate in the war on terror. They reject the idea that there's a war on terror. This, they said, were acts, this plot, to the extent that we know what it was the production of criminal murderers. And all Britons, all communities are united against that threat. That's the attitude that the United States needs to take as well. Focus on the possibility on limiting, controlling the amount of nuclear material floating around in back channels, and try to make sure that these groups don't get their hands on it. In the meantime, isolate and delegitimize them by depriving them of the conditions in which they prosper. If I can just say one more thing on that. It's as if, and I know this is a strange metaphor, but it's as if we're in a pot of water that's being heated up, and our job is to watch every molecule and prevent it from bursting into steam as the water approaches the boiling point. That's what we're doing. We're looking at all these molecules and trying to find the one that's going to burst into steam. What we should be doing is turning down the heat underneath the pot.
Now, is part of that what you're saying is that we should not have declared a war on terror and mobilized the national resources necessarily and made this priority number one, but more have taken it as a law enforcement approach?
Exactly what I'm saying. And you'll remember that John Kerry in October 2004, in a New York Times interview, actually said this. He said, look, we're always going to have this kind of terrorism, some kind of terrorism like prostitution, like organized crime, but we can deal with it with our enemies discreetly, carefully, effectively, and firmly. When he said that, the war on terror ganged up on him, Republicans and Democrats, and forced him to retract it, and he came out swinging with the same old rhetoric, I'm going to fight the terrorists, I'm going to fight the war more viciously than George Bush, because the war on terror is what's in charge of what politicians say, not the politicians.
So do you think that one of the weak points in this sort of system that's helping fuel this is Congress and their lack of spine to stand up for what maybe they really know or believe, and what about the media as well?
The media and Congress, politicians, economic interest groups, I'm not singling out anyone. They're all caught in the same trap. But
right.
Let's take
Democrats,
the media. Let's take the media or the Congress. Think of what happens when a blizzard is approaching a metropolitan area like Philadelphia.
Yeah.
The local news media has a field day. The storm of the century is its build. And for a few days, those meteorologists and those announcers can barely contain their excitement, and they are the celebrities of the day. And revenues and viewership are skyrocketing. Then the blizzard leaves or hits and passes and that's gone. Well, what the war on terror is a kind of permanent blizzard that never hits, in which the media can use, whether it's 24, these television programs, or it's 9/11 coverage, or it's spectacular coverage of any announcement that there's a new terrorist alert. Very little coverage when that alert is announced to be now no longer in force, because the revenues for that kind of coverage are easy to get. They skyrocket, and so the media, like Congress, plays the game. Congress played this game during the anti-communist hysteria of the 50s when they fostered the idea under McCarthy that there were communist sleeper cells everywhere trying to and capable of destroying the country. Well, that word sleeper cell came into our vocabulary at that time. It's just as completely untrue now as confidential FBI memos have said. There is no evidence of sleeper cells whatsoever in the United States of these Muslim terrorists, and yet, how many television shows and movies are based on that plot?
Right. But what are you – when a reporter calls you up after, say, a bomb goes off, a dirty bomb goes off at the port of Baltimore or Philadelphia, what are you going to say then? I mean, that it was – you know, it was an anomaly that it went off?
I'm going to say that if God forbid anything like that happens – that insofar as we could have prevented it, we inhibited our ability to do so by fighting the war on terror as this gigantic political maelstrom instead of a well-defined, carefully targeted application of our resources to a limited and discrete threat, rationally applied. And that's what we did when we faced the Soviet Union. Could have, and we knew it, incinerate us any hour. It was a much more serious threat than Al-Qaeda. And we did go through a period of hysteria in the early 50s. But thanks to people like George F. Kennan and others who thought very clearly about the weaknesses as well as the strengths of the Soviet Union, what they were really capable of and what they weren't capable of, we came up with a disciplined policy that we could sustain over a long period of time, containment, that eventually led to the defeat and collapse of the Soviet Union.
Okay,
we need that kind of discipline now.
Okay, so George Kennan was 1947. He was what, a State Department official in Moscow?
He was a State Department analyst and representative in Moscow.
And what is it that he wrote?
He wrote first a long telegram, as it's called, explaining after World War II, when you'll remember that the Soviet Union was our ally, and he said, you know, they're no longer our ally. They are our enemy, and we need to realize that we have this enemy, but we can't take their rhetoric on face value. They want to bury us, but they can't. They may rattle their sabers, but we have to really see how weak they are in the long run. We should not fight a world war to defeat them now because they could hurt us. That would be the wrong thing to do. We can defeat them and stay safe and sustain a viable, productive national life by being clear about their weaknesses and how, by frustrating them, they will collapse after decades of struggle. That is not the kind of analysis that has ever been allowed publicly to occur in the United States with respect to the terrorist threat.
And that's what we need right now, is that type of thinking.
That's right. And that's the media's job. The politicians are hopelessly trapped until at least after this election. But at least media and academics and other intellectuals, as well as the public, can start to think, wait a minute, how am I being suckered here? Who's suckering me? Who's suckering whom? Al-Qaeda's suffering America? Are my politicians bidding on my fears, suckering me into supporting them for things we don't need, to bridges to nowhere forever? That's what we have to encourage people to at least start thinking about.
Our guest is Ian Lustig. He is author of the new book. It's called Trapped in the War on Terror. I'm Alan Tuin for Marty Moscowane, and we'd like to hear from you. It's 1-888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Allison. She's calling in from Mount Airy. Allison, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. This is a great show. Thank you for having it. I have a question regarding what Professor Lustig refers to as the administration cabal and their rationale for continuing to push the war on terror. He mentioned, of course, it being a facade for the war in Iraq, which has been a disaster. But I'm wondering, from that perspective of that cabal, as he refers to it, what do they get out of this? Is it just, you know, to win elections by keeping us all in fear, to keep oil prices high? What is their end game here in terms of what they're getting?
Excellent question, Allison. Go ahead.
Yes, you know, I don't even think they are in control of this anymore. They, what did they want from the Iraq War? You know, people, they, the war on terror is portrayed as, well, the Iraq War is portrayed as the central front in the war on terror, as if we're fighting the war in Iraq because we're fighting a war on terror. In fact, it's the opposite. We are caught in a war on terror because it was used as a tactic in order to get the country to fight a war in Iraq. What did that cabal want out of the war in Iraq? They were very clear about it. If you read the writings of the Project of the New American Century that united everyone from Feith, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, the whole Crystal, Weekly Standard, they're very clear about it in the late and mid-90s. They wanted to transform American foreign policy into assertive neo-imperial profile that would become a Churchillian heroic policy to distract Americans from issues that Democrats could win on. That's why they called it the New American Century, dominated by conservatives. That the conservative party, conservatives would not be able to win elections, they said, unless foreign policy were transformed into this kind of struggle. They therefore assumed that they'd be able to go into Iraq with a small force and win a glorious victory, and that would allow subsequent wars in Iran, Syria, and elsewhere, because the American people would learn that the United States military power was capable of delivering these victories. That turned out to be completely false, but the war on terror that they created took on this life of its own, and I don't see them having an end game to it.
Do you discount the neoconservatives' stated goal that what they really wanted was to bring democracy to the Middle East?
I think that was something that they wanted, and that it had to do with other objectives as well, including security of Israel. But they did not at all entertain any critical assessment of how likely that was, of how you get democracy in third world areas. In fact, as I show in my book, and as many others have shown, every attempt to ask questions about whether the Iraq War would have that effect were squashed by the architects of the war. And so, yes, they did. They used it as icing on the cake, but it was a completely misguided and predictably a wrong strategy.
All right. We're talking about, is the war on terror actually working? Our guest is Ian Lustig, author of Trapped in the War on Terror. This is Radio Times, and we'll be taking more of your phone calls after this break.
JU Northeast supports WHYY. At the Keswick, Pink Martini this Wednesday, and Ian Anderson playing Orchestro Jethro Tull Tuesday, October 3rd, sponsored by Dreyfus. Tickets at Keswick's box office or keswicktheater.com.
Did you ever get into a hot debate about an issue you really cared about? And while you pulled out every great argument you could come up with, your opponent met you every step of the way, and you thought to yourself, hey, this guy's no dummy. He's actually making some really good points. Well, that's what it's like on Justice Talking, debates between passionate people who are on their toes and know their stuff. I'm Margot Adler. Get ready to get challenged on Justice Talking. Tonight at 10 on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day, when Hurricane Katrina ravaged New Orleans, it also hit the city's juvenile detention centers.
The whole jail just stank. The toilets was backed up. We was hungry. I ain't eat for 5 days, and plus I was pregnant. None of us was over the age of 16.
A year later, there's a new campaign to fix New Orleans' troubled juvenile justice system. That story next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The teachers and school support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association are pleased to underwrite Public Radio Capital News with features, analysis, and news from the state capital, PSEA, Leadership for Public Education.
This is Radio Times. I'm Alan Tu, in for Marty Moscowane this morning, and we're discussing whether the war on terror is actually working. Our guest is Ian Lustig. He's author of a new book. It's called Trapped in the War on Terror. And Lustig is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. He also has a book signing coming up this Thursday. That's going to be at the Penn Bookstore at 5:30. Excuse me. And we'd like to know what you think. You can call at 1-888-477-9499. I'll get to you in Ian, just a moment, but let's go to the phone call. Let's talk to Scott. He's calling us from Princeton, New Jersey. Scott, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. I have to agree with your guest completely. I was one of the first search and rescue people on the site of the World Trade Center. And 4 years later, I ran the boat teams for the 82nd Airborne at Katrina. I've seen a complete denuding of our ability to rescue because we're losing funds to Homeland Security. I think one of the worst signs of this is that it's 5 years after the World Trade Center. One of the first things we heard about it was our radio system didn't work on the site. Mm-hmm. And then the 9/11 Commission report comes out, and one of the biggest things is our communications didn't work for the New York City Fire Department. And it's 5 years later, and the New York City Fire Department has the same comm system it had on 9/11. And it's kind of apropos of a week later that we're still discussing something like this. Our funding's gone to all the wrong places. Toys for the boys instead of being goal-oriented.
Fair enough.
I think we actually have the best military we've ever had, and they proved it down at Katrina. They did a better job than our team of teams.
Right, but you're saying that the priorities are all out of whack here in terms of who's getting money, who's not.
Well, definitely. No matter what, we are going to have a major terrorist incident. I absolutely believe they're coming back, but we're not capable of dealing with it.
All right. Scott, I want to give Ian a chance to respond to this. Thanks very much, Scott, for calling in. This goes to your point. I mean, some of the money where it should go isn't.
Well, I think the caller, of course, knows better than anyone that how many of our first responders have been cycling and recycling back into Iraq and out as national because they're in the National Guard or the Reserves. That's on the human side, just how many of our resources are being not only misappropriated, but appropriated in a way that plays directly into the hands of al-Qaeda, that helps them resurrect themselves from the dustbin of history and become a player on the world scene that the President of the United States says is akin to Hitler or Stalin. So it's not just a misappropriation. It's the way our system has worked. It's so diabolically clever in a way by the terrorists and unlucky for us that I don't want to blame it all on the administration. You know, this is way out of the control of anyone. You take good-hearted people, honest people, working in any agency in the government, and what are they thinking about? They're thinking about two things. One is I don't know when the next terrorist attack is going to occur, if it's going to occur. But I do know that if it does occur, afterward, everybody will figure out who didn't approve the program that could have protected it. Therefore, in order to cover my ass, which is the slogan in the government, I'm going to approve every single thing or criticize it for not being generously funded enough, no matter what it is. This is also has interfered with the government's ability to chase down good leads, separate good leads about possible terrorist threats from bad leads. Nobody wants to miss the lead that afterward will be seen as the responsible for 9/11.
Ian, in your book, Trapped on the War on Terror, you give an example, I believe, right after the anthrax attacks, which really, I think, illustrates this point that there's not a good way to sift through All of this. Can you explain exactly what you mean?
Well, right after the 9/11 attacks, I was asked to help the FBI set up a a conference to learn about how Americans and how the American government could deal with this new environment of enormous risk, but maybe not as much risk as it seemed like. How could we assess risks? And there were hundreds of analysts from all through the and detectives and others who came to this conference. And meeting with some of them was extraordinarily illuminating. And I had a conversation with some, and one of the one man from a major metropolitan area told me how that he was getting thousands of tips a day. Their office was getting a week, thousands of tips a week. And I said, my goodness, how can you decide among those tips which ones you're going to take seriously? He says, sir, we take every one of them seriously. We chase down every tip. I said, but that's impossible. He said, well, we do it. We have to do it because any one of them could be the next 9/11. And I tried to point out that inevitably, you're going to separate some you deal with and some you don't. If you don't think about how you're doing it, it's just going to be random. But that's that that fear that surged across all of the departments in the government and through American society, in which which is reinforced by every agency's fear that if it doesn't come up with a war on terror argument for why its funding needs to be increased, the agency across the hall will come up with a better rationale.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you, since the time right after the September 11th attacks, and they were followed up just, I think, a week later with some of the anthrax letters.
Yes.
I mean, the times are pretty crazy then. I mean, do you really blame anyone for the reacting the way we did? Could you expect American society to have reacted any other way?
I was here during those attacks, and I was certainly afraid, but my judgment was, and I made it clear, that the anthrax had nothing to do with Muslim terrorists, and that the main problem was to calm down enough to be able to assess the real threats against us. And at that conference I mentioned, I spoke to very high-level officials, and I told them that my single best recommendation was to stop showing the Twin Towers being attacked over and over and over again on television, because psychologically it creates the impression in viewers that something absolutely horrible of that magnitude not only is much more likely to happen than it is, but it's going to happen to them because they are personally seeing it over and over again, as if giving a kind of post-traumatic shock syndrome to the entire country. And when I told these officials that, they responded in a chilling way. They said, we thought of that, and we have passed that advice up to the political echelon to advise the media, tone it down. But we were told that certain elements in the political echelon did not want the anxiety level of the country to be reduced for political reasons. And those political reasons were indeed to gear up the country, keep it its anxiety level high in order to justify the war in Iraq.
But certainly, I remember not long after September 11th, once we adopted the Homeland Security, the kind of color scheme for a terrorism risk, and there were lots of they pushed the button a lot, and we went into the – I'm not even sure of all the levels, but we went into high alert many times or something like that. But haven't we learned the lesson, though? I mean, they don't elevate it every other week anymore.
Now that we're in the – what has happened is in the 4 or 5 months prior to elections, whether 2002, right, 2004, you see a bunch of alerts, and I expect that we're going to see them this time also. We also see that when the alert is raised, the news media spends an enormous amount of time talking about it. But when the alert is reduced back to yellow, you hardly hear about it. The fact is that from 9/11 till today, there's never been lower than yellow.
Right.
That is elevated. And when I talk to people in the government, I point out that on the Department of Homeland Security website, it says that when the code is at yellow, we're all supposed to be checking our supplies, getting new duct tape.
Right.
We're all supposed to be checking out new escape routes. I said, are you really doing that? They said, what? Is that what it says on the website?
Right, exactly. Go ahead.
So the point is that the officially they can't reduce the rate because that would blow the cover, as it were. That would hurt the war on terror. The war on terror will not allow it to be reduced below elevated, but it's obviously not an elevated threat everywhere in the country for 5 years. And if it is, that just goes to and there haven't been any attacks, that just goes to show how completely off base the entire system is.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Al from Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. Al, you're on Radio Times. What's up?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask your guest here, with the media being economically reinforced for preserving the status quo through its viewership and as well the politicians getting more votes for continuing fear-mongering. And indeed, the media supporting politicians, you know, who are over the top and kind of ignoring politicians with a more rational bent, we seem to be in this spiral that preserves itself. You know, the media needs to keep its money going, so they continue this. The politicians need to keep their votes going. And the media supports the politicians that the people are going to be seeing on TV. Who needs to change? Who needs to make a change to actually break this cycle and get us back on the right track? Is it the people need to stop watching the news and stop giving them money, or is it the politicians need to, as a group, be more rational, or does the news media need to change their rhetoric? I mean, what is it that's going to get us out of this?
Good point, John. Thanks.
Well, if you were a student of mine, you'd get an A, because you got the argument exactly. There is no easy solution. But let's say a couple things. First of all, it is the job of intellectuals, okay? It is not to go with what people expect to hear and want to hear, but to think for themselves. So one of the great dismays that I have had is that the intellectual community in the United States has not stood outside the war on terror and subjected it to the kind of critique that it deserves. This is beginning. This, my book, there's a book that's going to be coming out by John Mueller, which is some others have been speaking along these lines. You had an article by Jim Fallows in Atlantic Monthly. People are starting to. So that's one thing. You can, you know, it's such a huge discrepancy between what's actually there and what the evidence is that eventually people can't avoid not looking at it. Just discussing it is a crucial thing. The other thing, let's look at what happened in the 1950s. Finally, after 5 or 6 years of McCarthyism, President Eisenhower made a speech that put it on the line who McCarthy really was. He was a thug, and that had the effect of bringing to a halt the worst parts of that hysteria. There can be leadership, but he didn't run on that platform. So the next administration, especially the next president, will have an opportunity to say, wait a minute, let's all take a deep breath, look at the mistakes that have been made.
Whether it's Democrat or Republican, that's
Democrat
what you're saying?
Or Republican. But it's going to have to probably come from the top. And I can tell a story that Alexander Solzhenitsyn tells about Stalin in his book, The Gulag Archipelago, that there was a factory meeting in the late 1930s outside of Moscow, and Stalin's name was mentioned. And everyone stood up in the audience and on the dais and started clapping. And they clapped for 2 minutes and 4 minutes and 5 minutes, started looking at one another. They were still clapping at 6 minutes. They were all afraid to be the first one to stop clapping. When Stalin was in the room, he could raise his arm and everybody could sit down. But there was no Stalin to say, okay, it's all right. Finally, the factory director sat down. And everybody immediately stopped clapping, but he was sent to Siberia for 10 years the following week.
All right, let's go back to the phone call. Let's talk to John from Wynwood. John, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Professor, you keep using the word cabal. You use it when you write in The Nation magazine. A cabal is a secret group of plotters. You discuss how Wolfowitz, et cetera, were writing published articles about their goal. Cheney is not a secret person. Rumsfeld is not a secret person. Seems like you and Pat Buchanan are both mesmerized by this secret cabal of neoconservatives. Why do you keep using that word?
All right, John, thanks.
Well, the dictionaries I checked don't say that it has to be secret. And in the war against Mexico back in the 19th century, there was a junto or cabal also at that time that was not secret but very, very effective. The same kind of group operated to get us into the Spanish-American War. If you remember the old slogan, remember the Maine. But in this case, even members of the cabal call themselves a cabal. And I quote those. I have those quotations in the book. So somewhere between a secret conspiracy and a very public movement. This was a behind-the-scenes group that worked steadily and in a very organized way out of the government in the late 90s into the government after 2000.
Have the neocons lost all of their credibility, or are we likely to hear more and hear more about them pushing for action on Iran?
Well, I think that's their last hope, is if they can get a war going in Iran, they can actually generate. The war on terror in that way can generate its own the enemies it needs. that is, the Iranians and their Hezbollah allies have the capacity to attack us in a much more serious way than al-Qaeda does. We should not be going to war in Iran, but this is where the same group of people from Krauthammer and others are heading, trying to beat the drums for a war in Iran.
All right, let's go back to the phones. I want to get one more call in. Jack from Trenton, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes, Professor, I'm really enjoying your show. I wondered how much you think the war profiteers might have had input into the war in Iraq, and also the domestic problems with taxes and Social Security and Medicare, if that might have been a motivating factor to be able to justify reducing all those because of the amount of money we have to pay for the war. Well, I'll take my answer
right
off the air.
Jack, thanks very much. The military defense industry, is it their agenda here too?
I don't present any evidence, and I haven't been looking for it, but I don't present any evidence that there was this group of industries that wanted the war in Iraq in order to profit, but that rather they were perfectly poised
right
to do so. And that success then rippled through the society into every sector. I pointed out even the gun control lobby or the NRA, everyone uses that. Now, as to the second part of the question, in general, I think there's been a strategy to spend through tax cuts in order to starve the government of funds so that you could then later more easily cut back on social welfare programs. In that context, the very, very expensive war in Iraq, it fits right into that mold. Starve the government of funds so that programs we are afraid to publicly cut now will have to be cut later.
Ian Lessig, last question. Do you think that the midterm elections, if Democrats were to take power of the House or possibly the Senate, that would do anything to change this debate, the dynamics of this debate?
Well, the run-up to the election is unlikely to, because Democrats will be generally as unwilling as Republicans to break from the rhetoric of the war on terror. But afterward, then if the Democrats gain control of at least one house, you can have real hearings on the war on terror and on the war on Iraq that will inevitably enrich the discourse and bring out many things that most Americans are unaware of at this time.
All right. That's going to do it for our discussion today. We were talking about whether we're trapped in this war on terror. Our guest has been Ian Lustig. He's author of the new book, Trapped in the War on Terror, which was published this month by the University of Pennsylvania Press. He will be doing a book reading this Thursday at the Penn Bookstore. That begins at 5:30. I'm Alan Tu, sitting in today for Marty Moscowane.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.